I'm going to give you a quick review of the first book, because that message is already out there. I'm going to spend most of my time tonight talking about the second book and the ideas that have come about in that effort. I'm going to make the argument about the new map. I'm going to give you a sense of where I place the book, Pentagon's New Map, in comparison to the debate that's been going on since the end of the Cold War, trying to figure out, in effect, what we're fighting about. Go back to 1989. First really important book on the scene, I would argue, Francis Fukuyama, End of History and the Last Man. And he asked the essential question we've been wrestling with ever since, which is, after ideology, what's the fight about? Now, my old professor Sam Huntington put out a marker, his concept of the clash of civilizations, basic, quick historical tour. He talked about people clashing way back when. Over time, they organized themselves into states. Over time, those states organized themselves into blocks. And voila, we have the wonderful march of history. And this is what we face. So he gives us a point. On that basis, the debate starts. The debate is joined by one of the most influential books I've ever read, Tom Friedman's Lexus and the Olive Tree. At that point, we got a spectrum, I would argue. My shorthand for Friedman is basically globalization. Some people get it, some people don't. Eventually, everybody's going to have to. You should recognize this message. I like to describe it as fundamentally Marx on steroids. And if you read The World is Flat, Friedman's finally come clean on that, thanks to the help he got from Michael Sandel at Harvard, another old professor of mine. Sam's counter to that basically was globalization. Some people are never going to get it. Never. And that's going to be the basis of a lot of fight. What I tried to do in the Pentagon's new map was add a third point to that. In effect, create a plane. My argument for globalization was, and I'm really trying to combine the economic argument here, the social argument here, and give a third leg to that stool, political military. Much like Friedman, globalization, some people got it, some people don't. The spread is inevitable. It's been moving for the last 150 years. It gets stuck sometimes. It moves more rapidly sometimes. We can map that process. And on that basis, we can figure out where the future of war is going. Okay? That's the fundamental premise that underlines the map. Here's the original map that was done for me by Bill McNulty, who at that point was the map maker for the New York Times. This is the one that appeared in Esquire March 2003. And I love this map because it got me a book agent. You're looking at through 2005 now, about 150 cases where we sent U.S. military forces overseas. I describe this as the natural demand pattern for the exporting of U.S. security post-Cold War. Okay? When I say exporting security, I'm not talking about exporting arms. I'm talking about the time and the attention spent by our forces with regard to any region's potential or actual levels of mass violence. So where mass violence occurred and where we went to deal with it. Okay, all I did was draw a line around 95% of it. The countries on the outside, basically what I call the old core of the West, United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, and Australia, and then what I call the new core, or Russia, China, and India, Brazil, same four countries that Friedman focuses on a lot, or that argument from Clyde Prestowitz, 3 billion new capitalists. So my functioning core, as I describe it, basically your old West, your new East, some big players from the South. I call it the functioning core of globalization, roughly two-thirds of the human population, national economies coming together much more rapidly than people realize. Get past some old misunderstandings, some old tailbones from the Cold War. There's basically no reason for these countries to go to war. So the role for the U.S. military, fairly latent. We got the biggest gun. That plus nukes raises barriers to entry to the marketplace we used to call great power war, which we haven't seen on the planet since 1945. Okay? Doesn't mean everybody in the core morphs into a middle class. Still plenty of poverty. Doesn't mean they're all democracies. I don't really care about democracies. My argument is, if the government allows broadband economic connectivity between the masses and the outside world, I don't have to worry about that country over time. Because they're going to have to sync up their internal rule sets with the emerging global rule sets that allow that money and that connectivity to flow. We're watching that right now with China. So I don't worry about democracies. Most countries that are going to make the journey are going to do it as single-party states, just like Japan did, just like South Korea, just like Singapore still, like a Mexico, like a China and a Russia today. So a functioning core counterposed to what I call the non-integrating gap. And what I mean by that is, these are the regions least connected to the global economy. And to me, that's the underlying parameter that defines why there's violence there and why we end up going there so often. Okay? I make an argument. You could shrink this gap. And in effect, I think we did across the 1990s with regard to the Balkans. Okay? So I will argue that the Balkans, in effect, are part of a functioning core now. Doesn't mean they're democracies. Doesn't mean there's not a lot of poverty. Still a lot of bad blood. It means in terms of direction of change, they are moving towards greater connectivity. Never pretty. Typically takes a long time. The mantra from the first book, disconnectedness defines danger. I had a guy from USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, tell me, I'll tell you exactly, he said, where we're going to go in a global war on terrorism. And I said, really, where? He said, show me a country where we shut down a USAID mission. We'll be invading it about 5 years later. Because when the United States pulls out the USAID mission, they're saying, in effect, you are so far gone, I'm not even going to bother to try to connect you. And that's like putting a for sale sign out for Al-Qaeda. Because that means the government, in effect, can probably be bought cheaply or simply preyed upon. Like parasites. So my functioning core, thick with connectivity. In effect, I'm arguing you're looking at the spread of deep connectivity associated with globalization. And these are the areas to which that deep connectivity has not yet penetrated. You'll say, what about the Middle East? It's important because of oil. I'll tell you, it's about 1/5 of the world's population, about 3% of the trade. And the wealth that accrues from that is real. There is wealth in the Middle East. What there is not is development. Certainly not along the measures we'd expect with the kind of youth bulge working its way through the system right now. So my core coming together, my gap where connectivity is thin or absent in many instances. Since the Cold War, I can locate inside this blob all the wars, all the civil wars, all the ethnic cleansing, all the genocide, if you include the Balkans. All the mass rape as a tool of terror. All the children lured or forced into combat units. All the UN peacekeeping missions. All the U.S. nation building missions. Six. Unless you want to count Iraq as three. Then we're up to eight. I've had various Army War College students do data drills on this and say, in effect, if you mush the boundaries just a little bit, you can fit about 97% of the terrorist activity in the world, too. All inside that blob. I get asked a lot in terms of influence for these kinds of ideas. How influential do you think these ideas are? How much impact are you having on people's thinking? My argument, my answer is always, it's not a matter of influence, it's a matter of accuracy. People are attracted to this picture of the world because they find it accurate. It's not my invention. It's simply the historical record and an observation. Typically, it gets presented like this by OSD. They like to call it the Arc of Instability. I have an entire section in the Pentagon's new map called Why I Hate the Arc of Instability. As a concept, as a phrase. Here's a version put out by the Canadians about 6 weeks ago. They're chairman of the Joint Chiefs, in effect. Okay? And again, you get this weird pink coloring I can't explain. but I just let it ride. So Canada came to the same conclusion. Why? When they mapped where they went across the 1990s, they got the same picture. The Australians will come up with the same picture, so will the Brits, so a lot of our countries that we consider allies. Give you a three-pronged strategy coming out of this map. First, we work across the corridor to improve its ability to withstand and mitigate 9/11-like, this is the phrase we pulled out of the Y2K work I did years ago, system perturbations, a new definition of crisis, vertical shocks to very horizontally networked systems. I don't believe you can predict vertical shocks. I don't think you can prevent them 99 times out of 100. I do think you can model and get good at running down the horizontal scenarios or ripples that come out of that vertical shock. So can't stop Katrina, can deal better with New Orleans. So you got to preserve the core to grow the core. If you can buy an election in Spain with 10 backpack bombs, they're going to keep trying. So it's a question of improving our immune system response. And overwhelmingly, that's going to be a private sector function, which is taking off like wildfire now. And that's that concept of resiliency. Second, we got to discreetly firewall off the core from the GAP's worst exports, pandemics, narcotics, terror. I like to tell the story. Walking through Hong Kong International Airport last August, saw a screen on the wall, saw people walking across that screen. As I walked down the hallway, I went like this. Guy on the screen went like that. So I went over and talked to the technician. I said, "What's going on?" He said, "I just took your temperature." I said, "Really? I don't think I gave you permission. I'm an American." He said, "Not a problem. You're in Hong Kong." Okay? I got a temperature. I will win 48 hours, all expenses paid by me, vacation in Hong Kong, because it's against the law to travel out of that airport with a temperature. Now, why is that? SARS, avian flu. You're going to see that kind of technology replicated more and more. Third, most controversial concept. You've got to shrink the gap by exporting security to the worst situations there. And yes, making it better in terms of a global investment climate or a regional investment climate for multinationals to come in and, quote, unquote, exploit cheap labor, on average paying 50% higher wages than the local economy in similar industries. I know a lot of people inside that gap who would love to be exploited. What we see typically is not too much globalization, but not enough. And when I say not enough, I mean not enough access to outside capital. Because no one has grown their economy without access to outside capital. There is a myth that we built this country all by ourselves. But you go back and check the 1800s. The Europeans gave us money, 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 and exploited our cheap labor. Just like we're doing with China right now, with their unfair advantage of cheap labor. And then I argue you're going to need two different forces to do this. You already got the one for regime change. That force I call the Leviathan, an unparalleled capacity to wage war. What we do not have is what I call the second half force, the one that does the peace waging, the nation building, the crisis response, the disaster relief, the counterinsurgency, everything right up to and including your occasional Fallujahs. That force I call the sysadmin force. People love this name, sounds sexy, historic. This one they say, I don't know, I don't want to work for a sissy force. Sounds like a bunch of geeks with pocket protectors. I say, relax, I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the echo boomers. I'm talking to people about age 10 to 25. When you talk to them about networks and sysadmin, they get it. They get it all. They understand the complexity and the power of the notion. It's not geeks. It's how things get done. And if you're going to be a grand strategist, you're going to think about the future. You're not coming up with a grand strategy for this weekend or the next fiscal quarter or even, gosh, all the way through the QDR. You're coming up with something that's going to last for years and decades. And so you're going to talk to young people as much or more as people our age. Make an argument about structure following strategy. An explanation of that Leviathan sysadmin split, which I make purposely fairly strong, fairly stark. Because when I tell people it's a spectrum, then they say, you know what? I already got that covered. It's a lesser included. Got it covered. Don't buy for it. Don't train for it. Don't prioritize it. but I got it covered. We heard that explanation for years across the 1990s until we bumped into the reality called Iraq. People are admitting now, don't got it covered, not even close. So you're seeing people like Mattis, Petraeus, and you're seeing the effort, announced, I think it was New York Times today, about creating that school in Iraq. They're catching up to the echo boomers who've been doing this in chat rooms for the last 3 years. My argument for making it stark is, you got to stop pretending the same force is going to do both packages. Wasn't the case historically. There's no reason to expect why it should be in the future. You could train a 19-year-old to do the stuff on the left side. On instinct, you can train them to do that. We've been doing that for thousands of years. What you need on the right, paradigm is much closer to the 40-year-old cop. Serious wisdom, serious experience, the ability to handle situations 99 times out of 100 without pulling their weapon out of their holster. An argument in terms of op tempo. The rule, sysadmin is the force that doesn't come home. Those are the boys and girls that don't come home. They stay out there. The Leviathan force is something you break out on occasion with great deliberativeness. Okay? You do not emphasize strategic speed. You emphasize strategic inevitability. That is your deterrence value. If I want to, nobody can stop me. But here's the problem. Here's the promise that you got to make. The American public, to your own troops, to allies, to the world at large. I promise not to break out that Leviathan, not to wage war, unless I'm fully committed, fully prepared, fully incentivized to wage the massive follow-on peace effort that's typically required. Don't undertake the war unless you plan to win the peace. Otherwise, you're just going to do drive-by regime change. What you're going to leave in your wake is a situation that's frankly only safe for them, not safe for us. That's sysadmin function. And I like to call it a function because I don't like to make the troop issue the whole thing. Who owns what? Because in many ways, I think it's going to be more a virtual kind of company, a virtual kind of endeavor. People coming together, resources coming together to do issues, to do situations. But to me, it's all about sequencing. Okay, and we just saw this in Iraq, and we just saw it in New Orleans. Think about Iraq, mission accomplished as declared May 2003. Think about the goal of functioning sovereignty. We have fairly good experience with this. We're just beginning to crack the econometric models for the experience of countries coming out of conflict. Okay, and what we learned from that, and a good version of this is found in Bjorn Lomborg's Global Crises, Global Solutions, the book, the compendium of studies coming out of the Copenhagen Consensus. Bjorn Lomborg was the guy who wrote Skeptical Environmentalist, probably the best book I've ever read in terms of meta-analysis. Skeptical Environmentalist. Okay? My argument for the sysadmin process, it's going to be three big phases. The first is going to be primarily uniform military, peacekeepers. You flood the system with peacekeepers. Our historical experience is you get the number up high enough, your casualties go to zero almost. Then you flood it with civilian, I would argue, uniform police. I do not like contractors in this role. Too many problems. The worst diplomats we have. Then you're talking about civilian recovery. And that civilian recovery, first off, very much focused, quick and dirty, food in people's bellies, money in their pockets. You got to restart economic activity. And what we got in Iraq is basically America's Great Depression. Nobody's got any money, so you can't do anything. When people don't have any money, they can't do anything. Idle hands. You're going to get the long and hard recapture of the lost GDP from whatever conflict situation preceded this. Typically, we've learned from history, about years 4 through 7. So what countries need in years 1 through 3, typically, peacekeepers. If you give them money, you know what they do coming out of conflict? They buy guns. Okay? And that scares the insurgents, the fragile peace, whatever. And 40% of the time, within the first 4 years after a conflict ends, They restart it all over again. The biggest cause of civil war in the world today is actually civil war and the inability to break the cycle. Giving lots of money to a country coming out of that kind of situation is like giving somebody walking out of Auschwitz a Big Mac. They simply cannot absorb it. What they need are peacekeepers. And then what they typically see is they recapture all the lost GDP about years 4 through 7. If you can get them to about year 10, the likelihood of them collapsing back into civil war decreases dramatically. You basically solved your problem. Okay? There's no mystery here. If I was going to talk about what the U.S. role should be, my argument would be front-loaded. Because we have real skill sets here that are important in terms of command and control logistics, the ability to move lots of stuff in austere environments. Okay? You can transpose this entire thing to New Orleans. Just talk about the Fed instead of the U.S. government. Same arguments hold. What people get nervous about is actually having the military involved early on. But that's the only time they're really that much useful. And if you wait, you get a mission gap, as I call it. And we'll talk about that later. Okay? Other differences. The Leviathan, lots of traditional partners. They all look suspiciously like the Brits and their former colonies. Over here, you got to work with everybody. So this is basically about jointness and a coalition version of jointness. This is much harder, interagency, which much like jointness 10 years ago, used to mean I'll let the other guy do it. And that's basically the definition of interagency today. It's not my job. It's the interagency process. I call the Leviathan your dad's military. I like him young, male, unmarried, slightly pissed off. I call the sysadmin your mom's military. It's everything your dad's military fears and hates. Older, married with children, more educated, more gender balanced. This force is never coming under the purview of the ICC. This one's got to. This one's going to remain firmly under military law. This one's going to come under civilian law lots of times because most of these people are going to be civilians. This force is going to respect posse comitatus. This force is going to obliterate the distinction. Okay? And you're going to see people age out from the Leviathan to the sysadmin. How do I know? They already do it. Check out who works for private security corporations. They're all ex-military who just want to keep a finger in the game. The Leviathan's all about taking down networks, very familiar. The sysadmin's about putting them up, much harder. Controversial point, who gets custody of the kids? This is where the Marines in the room get kind of nervous. This is when they get kind of mad. If you read Max Boot, Small Arms, Small Wars, that's basically the history of the Marine Corps. They don't like the Navy. They never like the Pentagon. They don't like the Department of Defense. They want to be Marines. I say the Marines are like my West Highland Terrier. Every morning they want to get up and do two things. Dig a hole, kill something. I say let the Marines be the Marines. I don't believe in the three-block war. Okay? You give the Marines to the sysadmin force, it stops it from being the UN. Okay? You kill the aid workers, these guys come over and put a Fallujah on you. You're going to need that capacity. It's not going to go away. In terms of the Navy, strategic goes this way, surface combatants go that way. And as I like to say, that's going to be the actual size of some of them. One of the reasons I'm no longer working at the Naval War College is that I used to tell young officers, good news is you may command several hundred ships in your career. Bad news is most of them won't have anybody on them. Okay? But that's really the metaphor they're working towards. When Mullen reaches for that 1,000-ship Navy, oh, and I need to borrow 800 of them, he's really reaching for that because that's going to be a small ship Navy. Because nobody's got a blue water Navy except for us. Carrier's going to go both ways. Swing asset. Army. Airborne like carriers. armor, mostly this direction. Boots on the ground, here's the dirty secret of the Air Force. You can win wars from the air. Problem is, you can't secure the victory from the air. In terms of the Air Force strategic airlift, like carriers and airborne, bombers and fighters go this way, much smaller numbers. Why? Nobody even flies against us anymore. I have met the last Navy pilot involved in a dogfight. He's a one-star now. I've already met the last Air Force pilot ever to shoot anybody down. He's a one-star now. That's how distant we are from that reality. And I know you're going to tell me, the Indians are really great pilots. We saw it at the air show last year. I'm going to tell you, man, if you're reaching for the Indians at this point, just go straight on to the Borg. SOCOM and the trigger pullers, they go this way because they don't like to explain what they do. Civil affairs, that bastard child, goes back to its birth parents, the Army. Trigger pullers, as they like to remind me, have no off-season. These guys are always out there doing their thing. They drop in, they do their business, they disappear. Now you see me? Whoops. That wasn't me. The world is my playground. Rumsfeld has proposed the loosest possible rule sets for these guys. Why? Good argument. They're the ones most likely to put the hit on the guys who are most likely to kill the million in Chicago. And the political perversion of our system by that act outweighs whatever mistakes these guys make and cover up quietly. The reserve component, overwhelmingly, you got to renegotiate. I got a 20-year-old nephew over there now. He was promised 2 years of school. He got about 6 months. He was promised 90 days of training. He got about 42. His older brother, leading a platoon, going over right now, he's been in for 6 years. My family feels that is fair. They feel that his younger brother got shafted. And it represents how desperate we are. And on that basis, you just lost my entire family. And that's too bad. Because the first deal was fair. The second deal is where you blew it. So we're going to have to renegotiate those contracts and be much clearer with people about what we're asking from them. It's not about money. It's about being honest with people up front. In terms of the intelligence community, traditional muscle, the big assets over here, this should be what the CIA was designed to be. Analytical, open source. The model is the NIC, National Intelligence Council. Here's the thing we learned time and time again. War is classified. Peace, they will tell you what you need to know. All you need to do is ask them. They're not secrets. It's just called local knowledge. One of the great stories I've seen written about the echo boomers over there in Iraq, ages 10 to 25. It's the boom of the boom. Okay? And the oldest of the echo boomers are in the force now. Written by Dan Baum, New Yorker. He talked about the echo boomers going over there with their laptops, wiring themselves up, going into chat rooms, and teaching each other counterinsurgency. Because they said the Army hadn't taught them. The Army got mad. They said, you're breaking operational security. And the boomers, the echo boomers said, you dumbasses. Al-Qaeda already knows all this information. We're the ones in deficit. And so we're going to train each other. And you're seeing that bubble up phenomenon now get back through a Mattis, through a Petraeus, through that school in Iraq. You're going to see a revolution from below. Move on to the second book. Why do you want to write a second book? I get asked that a lot. Well, there's the usual answer. I didn't let that up long enough. There we go. Okay. The argument is this is a big job. It's going to take decades. It is a grand strategy. We're talking about connecting the disconnected. We're talking about making globalization truly global. We're talking about inviting one-third of humanity. Currently, noses pressed to the glass. Where all the war, where all the anger is. Terrorism is not about poverty. It's not about ignorance. It's about rejecting a future that they find incomprehensible and reprehensible. They can't connect to. But when we talk about that dime package and everything we have to bring to bear on this global war on terrorism, quite frankly, what I did in the first book was I argued from the Pentagon out. Okay? So the second book was about expanding the vision. I started with the Pentagon because that's where the money and the bodies are. But if you want to do this well, You got to bring in the totality of the U.S. government. You got to bring in the big players in terms of who's got the money, who's got the legitimacy, like the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Whether we like it or not, that's where the legitimacy resides. In terms of content spread, what I did in the first book, like most books that pretend to be about grand strategy, I basically caught you up to now. My pivot point, tipping point for the Cold War in 1973. Okay? So what I do in the second book, if this is system diagnostic, second book, pure projection forward, nation state prescriptive. Okay? Reaching out to about 2025. And I wanted to put that in the title, but my publisher said no. Nobody buys books with future dates in them. They suck in the market. So our first operating rule for the second book was no flying cars. People always want to throw out a flying car. Technology is going to make everything okay. Thus, the focus of the book, next 4 or 5 years. And I'm going to make a bunch of arguments here that are going to seem like real stretchers. And again, they're not designed, quite frankly, for this generation. They're designed for the next generation. And on that snotty note, let's continue. Okay. I think we have a hard time understanding the rather yin-yang relationship between globalization and conflict. Okay? Some people want to emphasize just the integration. Other people, just the friction. Like it's a choice or something. But you know, in America, you either win the Super Bowl or you're a loser. So we're rather stark in our choices, rather conflicted in our competition. The rest of the world doesn't think of it in those terms. And that's really the disconnect in terms of strategic communications. We think it's always either or. The rest of the world always thinks of it in terms of a balance. I get accused a lot of being a connectivity idealist. With connectivity, everything's going to be solved. If we just connect up, no more war. Okay? And I get this one. You're the second coming of Norman Angel. Norman Angel's the guy who wrote The Great Illusion, 1910. He said, if the empires of Europe go to war, they'll destroy each other. Thus, they'll never go to war. Okay? He got the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1933. Sort of a consolation. 1933 was a pretty bad year to pick somebody for the Nobel Peace Prize. I admit, I am the second coming of Norman Angel. But I'm Norman Angel with nukes. And nukes ends great power war. Okay? The crystal ball effect tells us what Norman Angel was trying to tell the European powers in 1910. If you do this, it will hurt really, really bad. And he was right. They did destroy themselves. My argument on connectivity is there is a natural spiking of pain, conflict, resistance, nationalism, racism that comes with the onset of connectivity. I grew up in Boscobel, Wisconsin in the 1960s. There were two types of people there, German and Dutch. Okay, I couldn't possibly have been a racist. I didn't know anybody who wasn't German or Dutch. I actually had to go out and connect with the larger world to discover people not like myself. We see that phenomenon all the time. Until you connect, you don't have that kind of resistance or blowback. We're watching it right now between a Japan and a China, and it's totally natural. But it tapers off, historically. People get over it. It's a generational thing, by and large. Now, some people, like my friend Sam Huntington, likes to focus strictly on the friction. And again, the counter to that, Friedman, the international electronic herd he promised us in the 1990s, was going to ride herd over everything, basically didn't need much to deal with this globalization process. It would police itself through money and logic. And the answer we found out is that it's somewhere in between. My argument being 9/11 told us that globalization needs a bodyguard. Okay? So we have to be realistic about the amount of conflict that's going to come with globalization. And the spread of the global economy. It's been going on with fits and starts since the mid-1800s. We run into new enemies along the way. They were called socialists for a while, and then fascists and communists. Now we have a new name for them, the global Salafi jihadist movement. I remind people, the Pentagon is not in the business of waging war. It's in the business of commanding and building the future force. It dreams up future war and builds that force. That's what the Pentagon largely does. Right now, there's a big debate between two forces, two elements, basically the air crowd and the ground pounders. Okay, and it's all over what they call the barbecue. I heard this one last night, the barbecue. Budget, BRAC, QDR. Show me the beef, baby. Show me the pork. This is an argument largely through and between two camps. Net-centric operations, the air crowd, fourth generation warfare, the ground pounders. Okay? Can't forget the Navy. They got a lot of needs, and they got a lot of desire. Again, we need to optimize across the dial here. And this is the essence of the Iraq debate. Okay? This kind of theory of war debate. Basically, my old boss, Art Zabrowski, on one side, best representation, best book on the subject, Sling and the Stone, Tom Hamis, Marine Corps. Okay? Brief review, four generations of war. First, you blow up their people. Then you blow up their stuff. Then you blow up their industrial base. Then you destroy their will to fight. Targeting domestic. Okay? So it's basically the Borg versus the knuckle draggers. And they have very opposing views. High tech versus asymmetric. Peer focused, unequal. Bloodless versus bloody. The air crowd, again, the ground pounders. My argument is this is a false dichotomy. We need both capabilities. The question, again, is one of sequencing. Okay? So this is the basis for your big Leviathan. This is what keeps the big powers from entering the marketplace and allows us to wage war with impunity. This, quite frankly, is the mini-me Leviathan. It's the one within the sysadmin that you're going to break out on occasion. And that's been the role historically for the Marine Corps, the always-ready crowd. The sysadmin concept is a crucial sequential bridge. It's how you win and don't have to engage in fourth-generation warfare. But, of course, you have to have the capability. The reason why we have to win throughout the process is because our enemies have, in effect, cracked our code. Okay? I described first half, second half. This is my way of paraphrasing DSB's transition to and from hostilities. They said, in effect, our enemies have cracked the code. Do not fight the Leviathan. He will kill you. So sit out that struggle. Wait until they declare victory, go home, have a parade, send in the B team, then go on the offensive. Okay? We're going to meet this dynamic again and again and again. Because nobody's stupid enough to fight the Leviathan. You can call it asymmetric, fine. It's a fancy word that means he's not stupid. We're going to have to disrupt this game plan. And that's what I mean when I talk about the crucial bridge, which frankly is going to be grown out of these kinds of allies. In effect, if we just do that top line model, we can win the first half and we can go straight on to that Vietnam debacle. Or we can interrupt that process and secure a second half victory with a sysadmin force. We're going to have to do what we always do historically, throw people and resources at the problem. Okay? The absolute American way. Kill them with stuff. We ran a war game based on my book in Newport, June. We had futurist defense people playing China, Iran, Brazil, and the United States. And what was interesting over a 15-year game that we played was that every time we tried to prompt the Chinese into some sort of conflict, they'd say, no, you guys take care of it. You got the world's biggest gun. Now, after the fighting's done, we'll be happy to come in with our people who are incredibly cheap. We'll build the roads. We'll capture the markets. You don't want to deal with these nasty situations. Let us get the raw materials. We'll turn them into stuff. We'll send it to Walmart. My point is, we can't go alone in securing the peace. We're going to be self-deterred if we use this force. Because this force, absent this sort of effort, gets us nothing. We are a first half team in a league that insists on keeping score until the end of the game. If we had done the sysadmin effort comprehensively in Iraq, 300,000 peacekeepers, flood net system, would have been a lot more than just Americans. None of these things had to happen. The argument I get time and time again from the people on the ground, in effect, we had 5 months to feel the love and get the job done. Okay? And after 5 months, it's just like a power outage in the United States. Power outage in the United States, talk to anybody in the electrical industry. They'll tell you the first 3 days, it's pinochle, sterno cans, and getting to know your neighbors. Day four is when the guns come out. Because people are pissed at that point. Because they can't wash their underwear and stuff. Same basic phenomenon here, except instead of 3 days, we had 5 months. And at the end of that process, we basically lost the 90% of the population that was willing to go along with this. Because at that point, they said, you just took down the most powerful force in the universe, Saddam Hussein. Okay, and if you can't make the electricity run, then I know this is a conspiracy. Because you're the United States of America. Please. Then they saw New Orleans, and they were like, oh, okay, I get it now. You guys are just plain incompetent. The occupation is going to transform us far more than Iraq, okay? The Iraq war is not going to leave any imprint on the U.S. military. The Iraq peace, or lack thereof, is going to change everything. We got to understand better the seam between what I call war and peace, okay? This question, I love it. I was being asked for this 2000 mark for CNN. Just in the studio doing questions, they were going to run it in footage later. They kept saying, what do you think about the war? What do you think about the war? What do you think about the war? And I said, stop calling it the war. The war was done a long time ago. What we screwed up is the peace. And if you keep calling it the war, then you're going to come up with war answers. And you know what? That's not going to fix the peace. But we insist on that argument. Who lost the war? Who didn't do it right? This guy had it right. Small footprint. That force was there. It did its job. 137 combat casualties in about 21 days. There was nothing wrong with that war. This guy was also right, though. He was talking about something different. Shinseki. We should have had the 250,000 or 300,000. Because that's how you're going to win the peace. In effect, we have that Department of War. We got a Department of Peace. This is my bad cop. He mostly works the gap. He dreams of getting it on with the Corps, but he mostly works the gap. This is my good cop. He basically works the core. Frankly, that bow tie crowd doesn't have a clue in many instances about the gap, sad to say. What we're missing is somebody who works the middle. Okay? We do not war game the middle. I go to war games on the war. I go to seminars on the peace. What I do not go to is anybody who really models the transition from A to B. Okay? I argue, inevitably, you're going to get some sort of bureaucratic center of gravity for this. We got a department that works the gap. We got one that works the core. What we do not have is one that actually corresponds to the number one foreign policy goal for the next several decades, and that is getting countries from the gap to the core. Okay? Other countries have departments devoted to concepts like foreign aid. We're going to move in that direction, not because it's visionary or cool, but because we're going to screw it up time and time again. You master the middle, otherwise you don't win any lasting victories. So I make my argument, Blueprint for Action. For Department of Everything Else, I give it that comical name because I don't want to argue about the name. Call it whatever you want. Just don't call it the Department of Homeland Security. Historically, we define defense quite simply, defend the homeland. Security has been everything else. Okay? Written into our Constitution. Raise an army, maintain the Navy. Force for war, force for everything else. Department of War, a department of everything else. Defined historically as freedom of the seas, protecting our global connectivity on a day-to-day basis. Okay? 1947, our infinite wisdom, we merge it all together. And our long-term rationale becomes, in effect, the identity of national security and international security. You attack America, by God, I will blow up this planet. I am not kidding. Mutual assured destruction. Okay? And the problem we have now is that connectivity no longer holds. Osama bin Laden kills a million tomorrow in Chicago. Quick, name the country we bomb. Because if you can't name it, we can't deter it. And if you think 100 million dead Pakistanis is going to get you anything, I think you're wrong. And that's our basic problem. We need grand strategy that reconnects the definition of our national security and global security. Okay? This, I believe, was the worst strategic error we committed since 9/11. At the dawning of this great age of globalization, 3 billion new capitalists, the world is flat. We tell the world, buddy, I'm getting mine. You get yours. I can get security. I can get it all for myself. I'll get as much as I need. When in reality, we should have understood that it was the world that was telling us there's a lot of pain out there. Either we connect that world or we're going to deal with the consequences because they're going to bring their hurt over here on a regular basis. Okay? Everybody networks. And everybody's network security is only as good as every other network they're connected to. This is a basic logic from the world of IT that applies to countries in globalization. So I'm talking about managing, in effect, a management space between these three key pillars. Not just defining a war, not just defining a peace, but defining the transition. Okay? And what I'm really reaching for here is a way to tap into all the existing skill sets. Ultimately, I think, in terms of convincing allies that we're serious about this, we're going to have to put a marker against it. And frankly, we reached for the wrong one after 9/11. Tragically so. Again, this is going to be our foreign policy objective for the next several decades. People are telling us from all over the world. Okay, if we're listening, they're telling us that. And there's nothing that says this has to be a traditional department. In many ways, it should and could be more virtual than real. It should be an ability to network resources from across that spectrum. Like a movie company comes together and makes a movie. Tons of disparate parts. There's your new economy metaphor. Or frankly, the way the UN's done it. Okay? So instead of calling it Lethal Weapon 6, we could just call it Die, Robert Mugabe, Die, 2008. Why we're going to end up doing this is we've got to address this mission gap that's been developing. Okay, and the best description of this, Hans Benedict, Stu Johnson from NDU, Transforming for Stabilization and Reconstruction Operations. Okay, here's their basic logic. It makes perfect sense when you think about it. You go back to the Cold War. We put that Leviathan out there. It was big, big footprint all over the place. If we had to do nation building afterwards, we had lots of guys on the ground, so we just shifted over. There was a wonderful overlap. Okay? The problem we got now is, and this is why the argument between Shinseki and Rumsfeld was so idiotically portrayed in the media. How many troops do we need for the war? Okay? Well, we should have disaggregated it. So many for the war, so many for the peace. Okay? Because that Leviathan now, because it's transformed, doesn't have to be so big. You can get in and out rather quickly. Okay? Before that other guy can get started. And that's the mission gap. That's the poor handoff. There's your 5 months we wasted. It wasn't a theoretical experiment. It was taking natural advantage of what we created in the Leviathan. What we have not done is dealt with the sysadmin responsibility. And that's because we haven't addressed this fundamental series of rules that comes about. It's not a big enough screen for me to stand in the middle. But basically, the shorter the war, the longer the peace. And wars have gotten very short. The easier the war, and they have gotten easier for us, the harder the peace. The costlier the war, the cheaper the war, the costlier the peace. And then here's the most controversial one we argued about. The smaller the war force, the bigger the peace force, okay? That's a basic relationship. And we think it's a choice. It's not. So again, our adversary knows how to delay and defeat our intervention. And this model is going to work against us time and time again if we choose to go it alone. Instead, what we need is to build that hub and spokes, not so much in the warfighting force, frankly, we can do it by ourselves, but in the everything else force. And that's the force the rest of the world wants us to build, because that's the force they can work with, they can keep up with, they can talk to. That's basically what they're optimized for. And I argue you're going to have to make some sort of commitment. You're going to have to show the world you're serious about this. Otherwise, again, they're not going to pay for that Leviathan force. And if they don't want to buy our debt, guess what? We cannot afford that force. The Army is naturally ambivalent about moving in the direction of sysadmin. Okay? They lose their warfighting ethos if they move in that direction, they believe. I got to speak. After years of trying to bring me there, they finally got me to the Army War College in June to give a keynote to their end-of-the-year celebration. And the guy who hosted me said, "Well, I've been trying to get you here for 3 years." I said, "What's been the holdup?" He said, "A lot of the staff here think you're insane." And I said, "Well, that's pretty serious." I said, "What happened? How did I get so smart? Why am I here now? What was the tipping point?" They said, "It was the second tour in Iraq. You got a lot smarter with the second tour. I could be a genius by the third one." What we know from reenlistment is people like doing this kind of stuff. Okay? So we're looking at the Army moving off what has been a century of being the main war force and moving in the direction of the main peace force. And yes, they are going to eclipse these guys in a Freaky Friday-like switch. That's why you see the Navy retreating frantically in the direction of China. "Please, give me anything, anything on Taiwan. Just a sliver of hope." And this is why you get arguments. They're going to have to do it before the Olympics. Yeah, that's it. They're going to have to do it before the Olympics. The reason why the Army's going to go in this direction is because they're going to follow the money. You look at the supplementals. Okay, we don't budget for actual operations. If we do anything, we go over budget. That's the power of the purse strings. Supplementals, about $250 billion and counting since the end of the Cold War. Added up, DSB did, 80% post-conflict, stabilization, and reconstruction. I said that to Steve Cambone when I was interviewing him for this piece I did on Rumsfeld in the July issue of Esquire. And he said, "Hey, don't take from that that we should put 80% of our budget against that force. Do not assume that." I said, "No, I don't. But I do assume that you're going to have to move more in that direction." 80% and climbing. Okay? So you're going to watch the Army reverse a century of division structure. You have to go all the way back to the 1800s, dances with wolves, to find the kind of unit size that we're going to have again. Okay? We entered World War I. We ballooned into divisions. We kept them through World War II. We kept them through the Cold War. We are going back through Schoomaker, brigades, units of actions. Quite frankly, it's going to be a bait and switch historically. Here's Rumsfeld going, "Here's FCS, 2008. Come and get it, boy. Just jump through some hoops." They're going to have all these brigade units of action when they get to 2008, and then he's going to go, "You know what? It's too expensive." Schoomaker's going to be like, "You promised." And you know what? That would be perfectly fair, to be honest. So that sysadmin force is going to grow in DOD. It's going to be expunged over time because it's not going to be a core competency. But it's got to start here because the bucks and the money are here. They say, "Couldn't it start in the State Department?" Yeah, that and about 100,000 Marines will get you the State Department. Watching it grow and then get expunged over time is going to be like watching Halliburton grow increasingly uncomfortable with Kellogg, Brown, and Root, which is why they're thinking about putting them up for sale, because it's not their core business and it's a bitch politically. And they just don't want to do it anymore. You're going to see that kind of phenomenon again here. Make a large argument about how we're going to embed the use of our force within a larger rule set. John Kerry called it a global test. I'm comfortable asking about 20 countries. The rest, they can just live with it. Any good conventional recovery program, typically 12 steps. I don't got that long tonight, so let's just cut it down to 6. I'm a big Mel Brooks fan. The analogy is to economic bankruptcy, okay? We got a rule set provider for that. It's called the IMF. You go economically bankrupt, sovereign bankruptcy. I'm not paying my bonds anymore, okay? Russia did it in 1998. Argentina did it just this last 12-month period, okay? Russia paid 50 cents on the dollar. Argentina, much cleverer, paid 30 cents on the dollar, okay? They went in at A. They came out at Z. It's rather inchoate, this rule set. We change it every time we use it, but at least we're building one. It's semi-transparent. It's non-zero sum. People know that if you go in at A, you're going to get to come out at Z. You get to back on the court. You get to join the game again. And the reason why the system wants you back is because nobody wants you to fail. Just like personal bankruptcy. We want you back in the game. What if we had an A to Z rule set for processing political bankruptcy in the system, which exclusively, I would say, is going to be found inside the GATT, by definition. When I'm talking about politically bankrupt, two forms. Not enough government, failed. Too much government, authoritarian, dictatorial, rogue. Terrorists like both. So replacing those bad states with good ones is ultimately how you restrict the operating domain of international terrorism. That's how you win it over time. What would an A to Z system look like? I'm going to talk about front half again and back half. First half, second half. Okay, extant in the system right now, we got the UN Security Council. Basically, its function, grand jury. It can indict you. It can observe your bad behavior. It can invent new words for it. It can talk about it for months on end. It can vote several times, write it on a piece of paper, mail it, and then say in no uncertain terms, buddy, you better cut that out. Or else. I might sanction you. This is what got you the brilliant response to about 5 million dead in Central Africa in the 1990s. All the ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, 2 million dead in North Korea, preventable famine enforced from above, about 300,000 counting in Sudan. The African Union, what do they do as peacekeepers? They shoot photos, don't they? Way downstream, you got the U.S. Leviathan Force. In effect, it says, I'll be happy to take that guy down for you. I'll do it on Tuesday. It'll cost you about $23 billion. But I want to get home for the weekend. Okay? That force doesn't like to hang around. Way downstream, controversial International Criminal Court. Basically set up for the GATT. It's not set up to supersede any functioning government's legal rule set. Okay? We're afraid that if we go into the GATT, people are going to hold us accountable. Okay? So we've cut basically immunity clauses. Article 98 bilateral exclusionary treaties allowed under the International Criminal Court Treaty with virtually 100 countries, basically everybody inside the GATT. I call them interventionary prenuptials. Okay? What we're missing is somebody who translates will into action. And when we don't have that, we got to whip ourselves into a frenzy. We say it's us versus them. It's mano a mano. I got to get him before he gets me. It's an imminent threat. We haven't faced an imminent threat in about 40 years, and yet we wage war with regularity on behalf of the system. We use an archaic language to describe what we're doing. Okay? And frankly, when that didn't work for the White House this time around, the last minute they screamed, he's got a gun, just as we rushed in. And then we shot the place up. And then we looked over the corpse. We found an old cigarette lighter in the front pocket. And we said, well, it was dark. And we asked the French, do you want to go in next time first? You want to kick in the door and do the business? The French said, no. They said, but we like to make fun of you if you get your explanations wrong. So you got Chris Matthews every night on Hardball going, this was a war waged under false pretenses. Yes, Saddam was not a bad man. It was all about weapons of mass destruction. I don't arrest Ted Bundy because he kills a couple dozen women. I arrest him because he did it with a gun. And if I don't take him down with a gun in his hand, then that was a bad takedown, my friends. It's a brilliant logic. From people who claim they want a global community. Well, guess what? Global norms come with it. Guess what? Transgressors come with it. And guess what? You got to have a system for dealing with transgressors. We're missing that core-enabled sysadmin force. We should have had 50,000 Chinese, 50,000 Indians, 50,000 Russians, 50,000 Europeans, 50,000 Americans. Then they don't look across the line and see just an Occidental skin tone. Because frankly, the Occidental view that the West is decadent, dominated by its women, perverse, is that you just punch these guys hard in the face, you cut off a few heads, and you stream it on the internet. These guys will go running home to mama. Because that's what they're all about. They're weak and decadent. We've been running into this ever since Pearl Harbor. Okay? It's a constant myth. The reality is, of course, we're about the worst country in the world to pick a fight with because we just love violence. What we're missing is a permanent, what Sebastian Mallaby, Washington Post would call an international reconstruction fund. Model on the IMF. Do not pass the hat each time. Put the money out there. Putting the money out there is a big sign to the system. Yes, I'm coming for you. I've already budgeted it. You know, we tried that with Saddam. Frankly, it worked so well. You read in the New York Times today, we almost got a plea bargain out of him just before. We came this close to getting him just to walk away. You're going to get that from the G8, the functioning executive. That G20 is basically my entire core, old and new. They're going to determine how the money gets spent. Here's my challenge for DOD. We know this from war fighting. Unless you present a winning hand here, you will not get coalition partners because they cannot afford losses. Same thing here. Unless you show you can almost do this by yourself, they won't come. If you don't get them, you won't get the second half victory. If you don't get the second half victory, there's no point in using the first half force. You'll tell me that system is too much to imagine. I'll tell you that's basically how we did the Balkans both times. With NATO, Patty Ashdown, the High Representative, the UN groups that came together for that sysadmin work on the far side. All I'm talking about is regularizing it, making it transparent, making it non-zero sum. What we told our allies basically was, if you're too big of a pussy to show up for the war, do not show up for the peace, and forget about the contracts. And they said, well, I don't like that offer. And the ones who fought us the most were the countries that were most involved, Kelsapries, oil for food scandal, because they were concerned about the back half and who would get access to the oil. Who had developed Iraq's oil prior to all this going down? The French and the Soviets, okay? No big mystery. So yeah, this thing's going to grow inside the Pentagon, but you're going to have to internationalize it to make it real. Once you get the military capacity, then the rule sets will come, because they can't come in the absence of this capacity lending enough weight to their imagination. Once you get that A to Z system in place, basically you make your list, you check it twice. You define outright who you think is naughty or nice. You put the list out. I guarantee you, most times, the guy's going to take his money and his women and run the minute you name him. That's what Charles Taylor did when he was indicted by the Sierra Leone's war crimes. Okay? This can be done. We've done it historically. Then you're going to really do the integration through foreign direct investment. Because it's the private sector that's going to do it. Government simply can't put the money against the problem. Okay? It is not that hard. All the resources we need are in the core. We just spend it very badly right now. Mostly because we can't move off the past. And that's really what's frustrating the Army and the Marines. They say, if you're serious about this global war on terrorism, show me the money. Stop talking about it's all about China for the next 20, 25 years. An argument for the Middle East and how we're going to win this war, ultimately. Okay? What we're basically trying to do is connect the Middle East to the outside world. That's how we're going to get rid of the disconnectedness that leads to that sort of terrorism. We've got to give people options. What they have right now is a huge pool of youth that cannot connect to a future. I argue there are three seams in this process. I developed this argument after working with CENTCOM's J5 on their long-range plans. In effect, we got a tactical seam to the south. We go on the offensive against the global Salafi jihadist movement. If we're lucky, we're going to squeeze that balloon, we're going to push it all south. Because if it goes north into Central Asia, we're going to have a lot more friends all of a sudden. If we're lucky, we push it into sub-Saharan Africa. That's where the fight's been going. That's where it will go. We will not see less terrorism. We will see its center of gravity shift. This is Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's worst nightmare. He fears fighting it out in Central Africa 20 years from now. When he talks honestly to journalists, he says, in effect, we've been on a losing streak for the last 20 years. Everywhere we go, they kick us out. We're going to just fight on and on and on, worse and worse neighborhoods. Okay? That's why you're going to get an Africa command soon. There's an operational seam to the north. We go on the offensive here, so-called transnational terrorism, back to the reach pattern we saw in the 70s and 80s. They can blow stuff up in the Middle East, fine. With some effort, they can reach into Europe and increasingly southern Russia. Okay? So there's your connectivity to Beslan. There's Madrid. There's London. What they can't do easily is get all the way to the United States, because it's hard, because we got the pressure on them. But the key scene, the strategic one, lies to the east. Two-thirds of the oil that comes out of the Persian Gulf today goes to Asia. We take about 15%. In 20 years, we're going to take about 15%. Asia's going to take probably 80%. Our energy requirements go up about 25% over 20 years. Theirs double. And their car market quintuples. Three key players to connecting the Middle East to the outside world. The key linchpin here is Iran. It's the dominant player. We just took out its two worst enemies here and here. We left this guy, the happiest guy in the neighborhood. Okay? And the problem is, we got nothing for it. We did this guy a huge favor, and we got nothing. Okay? That's the state of grand strategy for us. Now we want to rerun the whole WMD thing with them. Why? It's our logic. We got two huge players with new leverage on Iran, if we just saw it. India and China have cut huge oil and natural gas deals with Iran. This is leverage. This is opportunity. This is connectivity we can take advantage of. But instead, we say, hey, you guys are just obstructing our plan to isolate Iran and keep the hardliners in power forever. It's a model we perfected with Cuba. Oil can't be the only connection, okay? But it's a good start on the leverage. We are not getting between these people and their oil. Trust me. Because they'll say, you know what? Then give up the House of Saud. Okay? You do same things there. Same arguments. You put up with bad guys who foment terrorism around the world. Our guy's just more honest about it. Okay? The Middle East is not the Wild West. I know this guy's very popular because he romanticizes the ground forces and SOCOM. Okay? He's a romantic guy. I think he's wonderful, but I think if you let journalists become your grand strategists, you're going to go straight to hell. Because it tells me you can't think for yourselves. I believe in civilian control of the military, but please, not journalists. The Middle East is not a bad neighborhood where everybody's a robber and there ain't no cops. Okay? It's not a place where the railroad's never going to come and settlers are never going to lay down stakes. Okay? This is a wonderful view if you want to do Mad Max from here on out. And it's very romantic. Cowboys and Indians, he calls it. Just kill them. Kill them all. You add an ideological stripe and you basically got Ann Coulter and drag. I like to complain about the occupation. I like to point out the success associated with the Big Bang. Okay? All these things have been happening in the Middle East over the last 24, 30 months. Okay? Many of these things we were told by regional experts were impossible. Weren't going to happen for years, decades, ever. Okay? And they've all happened in the aftermath of the takedown. My problem with the Bush administration is they have thrown the chessboard into the air, they got the game running, and they refuse to play. Instead, they just go right back to the same script on Iran with weapons of mass destruction. Okay? And we're letting the UN do our business in Syria. The most important one here, frankly, not well covered. Foreign direct investment has doubled into the region. Biggest problem with the Middle East is the lack of access to outside capital. There's your exit strategy. I know it's not a popular one, because it doesn't sound like the Marines or SOCOM are going to win it all by themselves. We can write it up in a fabulous Robert Kaplan book. But it's all about demographics. Fertility has already begun its decline throughout the region. There is a big youth bulge that we got to work through. Iran's a good example, 70% of the population under age 30. Okay? So the Big Bang starts a process that we got to keep going because it's all going to be about jobs. And what's key is showing our commitment. The money flows in knowing that there are not yet a big private sector and there's a lot of state involvement. And the money that's been flowing into Egypt has been absolutely amazing. Just since that PM, the Prime Minister, started some economic reforms. All the private sector needs to see is a wedge and enough commitment on security, and they will start the process for you. It doesn't have to be perfect. They're willing to go in and take risks. They just got to see the right trajectory. The battle we wage is one of connecting the Middle East faster than this guy and his crew could disconnect it. They fear globalization's creeping embrace because in 20 years, they will not be able to turn back the clock. It will be gone, the world they seek to preserve. Okay? So they're just the latest version of the resistance to the spread of the global economy, going all the way back to the 7th century, almost pre-economic alternatives. They focus on us because of Israel, because they see us as the face of globalization. In 10 years, nobody's going to make that association so easily. Because China, India, Brazil, Russia, they increasingly dominate the face of globalization. Japan, Europeans. It's not just an American-led affair. Watch them wrestle control of the internet away from us, which is absolutely hilarious. You know, it's like, it's my toy. I won't let you have it. Okay? The Salafi jihad has to be put in perspective. There's a big pool of disgruntled Muslims around the world who are unhappy with our policies. Okay? Change those policies, you'll buy these people. It'll get you nothing, but you'll buy these people. Smaller subset you could describe as the Islamists, who basically argue that governments in the Middle East should be based on Islam. Fine. Our country's based on Judeo-Christian. I get it. A much smaller group, the Salafi movement, talks about that basic fundamentalist desire. To remain pure, I've got to separate myself from the outside world. The version in Christianity most people are familiar with, the Amish. Okay? The global Salafi jihadists, basically, are the Amish with guns. Not just no, but hell no. Okay? And they're going to fight and kill and die. The closest we've come to this package was Quraysh. Millenarian, apocalyptic, I will take you all down with me. Okay? He was a lone nutcase in our business, in our culture. We're going to meet him time and time again, but he's basically rather rare. This guy is not. And we know what his target is. This is not a clash of civilizations. I'm with Dan Pipes. Islam is not the problem. It's the solution. We're watching the Reformation occur inside, not just the United States, but also inside Europe, where you're going to see Islamist parties rise in the same way that Marxist parties rose in the second half of the 20th century. Not only is this good, this is completely natural. You've got to let them into the political process. It'll be scary. A lot of older people in Europe will find it very incomprehensible. But read Olivier Roy. Fukuyama's got a great op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today about Roy's book. I use it a lot. Globalized Islam. Okay? What we're seeing inside of Islam is a response to globalization and an attempt to find peaceful integration with it. It will be tumultuous, just like it was for every other culture or society that globalization has crept into and embraced and reformatted. So we're running a variety of races. Al-Qaeda knows it has so much time to turn back the clock. Otherwise, the Middle East is lost. The House of Saud knows it's got to process that youth bulge. America knows, frankly, we got about 20 years to care about that region. Hopefully, we fix it before these guys figure out they might want to transform the region. Because, again, it's going to be their oil. And they know about it. When you talk to the Chinese, they know about it. They're not confused on this subject whatsoever. Okay? I argue Iran is the key. It can veto our efforts throughout the region. It can disrupt the flow of oil. It desires a place in the corridors of power. It believes the weapons of mass destruction round is the way to get it. Okay? Our fixation on the mechanism is bizarre. We need to ask ourselves what they want from nuclear weapons, seek to provide them that, and frankly, what they want is a promise we're not going to invade them. Fine, I don't think we are. Okay? And what they want is recognition that they're the dominant military power in the region. And guess what? They are, other than us. If we want to find stability in the Middle East, we're going to have to get it with Tehran's help. Because they can certainly make it miserable for us. All the reasons why Nixon wanted them are still there. We're looking at the equivalent of late Brezhnev USSR. Tired authoritarianism, bankrupt ideology, failed revolution, the mullahs pretend to obey, the mullahs pretend to rule, and the public pretends to obey. Great article in Variety, I blogged it last night. The mullahs just put, Ahmadinejad's government just put a new ban on certain foreign films, which only account for 3% of box office in Iran. Okay, foreign films. The estimates in terms of the black market, is the actual revenue flow is something like 50 times that amount. Okay? You can get any movie you want in Iran. Probably the day it comes out in the United States. That's how sophisticated that black market is. Same thing I found in the Soviet Union living there in the mid-1980s. So I argue you can kill that authoritarian regime with connectivity. Same way we did with the Soviet Union. You basically flood them with economic and foreign influences. You do that by giving them what they want in order to get their cooperation in the region. We're going to do it inevitably. The question is how long it's going to take us to realize it. Again, these are the countries we can bring to bear in terms of connectivity to the outside world. We need friends, though. Europeans obviously have a huge role to play. Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, the question of accession to the EU. Russia brings a lot to the table in terms of their interests, their connectivity in the near abroad or Central Asia. With China, you get a long-term relationship with Pakistan, budding relationship, almost an alliance with Iran. India, long-term mentoring of Iran, the elder brother as they see themselves, and then a lot of connectivity in terms of the Gulf states. There is no way we're going to end this conflict and really achieve victory unless we bring in a lot of other players to help us integrate this process. Again, we're trying to connect the Middle East faster than they disconnect it. An argument for what we need to do in a global war on terrorism. Plenty of press on this today. Okay? We need a rule set that deals with all these issues. Okay? Because if we don't have one, we're going to have a rule set of 1.5. Basically, the U.S. and the Likud party. I've already talked about a rule set for processing states. We need a rule set for processing individuals. Okay? Processing states is how we win over time, but we're going to have to deal with individuals in the meantime. Okay? Scandal is going to drive this process. We're going to try to keep it a very closed club, but people are going to force their way in on the basis of us screwing it up again and again. So we're basically going to play the Orkin man. Having been a superintendent, I know, you come in, you spray one apartment, they go to the next apartment over. Okay? This has been the history of Al-Qaeda for the last 25 years. They claim victory with each movement, okay? And we buy that propaganda like you wouldn't believe, just like we bought propaganda from the Russians. But we've got to remember the conflicts with individuals, not with affected nations. We're not going to offer these guys truces. They're a bunch of outlaw Josie whales. We're going to hunt them down and kill them. And yeah, we're going to exploit their incoherence over time. Because I believe, quite frankly, that Tony Soprano's son is dumber than he is. And after we get through Tony Soprano to his son, we're going to go for the idiot cousin, the idiot brother-in-law, and then the nasty sister. We're going to keep going on. It's going to be a mafia war. We should be honest about it. So we're going to seek to disrupt connectivity wherever we find it. We're going to have to figure out how to track them, too. So yeah, it's going to be an ugly set. We're going to admit we got one rule set for the core, law enforcement, and another for the gap. We find them, we kill them. But we're going to have a system for dealing with these individuals. We cannot just leave smoking holes in our wake. That cynical kind of description of civil affairs that, frankly, Kaplan likes to engage in. So we've got to be serious about civil affairs. We've got to move it back to the Army. It's going to be a long-term thing. Just saying that big Army's bad at it is not the answer. Big Army's going to have to get good at it. So it's okay for us to have a kind of a Dirty Harry response to 9/11. We get mad, we get pissed off, we start breaking some skulls. But ultimately, we got to start expanding the definition of the rule set. We have to make it more transparent. We're going to grow this quietly and in a very collusional fashion, starting with our closest friends. And frankly, we already got that rule set. But it's being exposed on the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Washington Post, seemingly on an everyday basis now. Eventually, we're going to have to move to describe some sort of new rule set. I don't think it's going to be based on Geneva. I think it's going to be based on the new rule set we develop with our closest allies. But we're going to have to grow it over time, and eventually we're going to have to connect it to the ICC. Because we cannot have these secret gulags. An argument for securing the East, which I think is the number one problem other than dealing with the Middle East. Okay? China is very attractive. She provides us many things. All our fantasies are fulfilled. What was so great about 9/11 is it allowed us a big chunk of time to reimagine China and to realize the lesser includeds now are basically the main course. Now, there are big chunks of U.S. military that will not get off the big one. We saw China resurrected by the Navy and the Air Force as they started losing arguments in the QDR this spring. It's quite hilarious to discover China, all of a sudden, has been building a Navy. We weren't aware of this for the last 10 years. In fact, there was a bit of a conspiracy by China lovers inside the intelligence community to hide that fact from us. I'll admit I'm biased on this score, okay? My wife and I had 3 biologicals, 1, 2, 3, and then we adopted her. Second daughter, fourth child, maybe a fifth column. Certainly a sixth deduction. China's rise is a choice for us in terms of how we handle it. Okay? I will argue our relationship with China is going to define the 21st century. It's going to be bigger than our relationship with the UK over the 20th century. Okay? I don't think there's an alternative. People will argue there is. I don't think so. Okay? What they offer us in the theory of peacefully rising China is not a promise, but a request. Not to interpret their rise as a threat. The internal integration process inside China dwarfs the external integration process with the outside world. Most people just don't get how big China is. People-wise, there's like three EUs in there. I admit, we are stuck with this guy for the current time. What I mean by that is a generational argument. The fourth generation leadership represented by Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao, that's the group that did not travel abroad for their education. Third generation went to the Soviet Union. Fifth and sixth, I went to school with. Okay? The fifth and sixth generation come online around 2010. When they come, be ready for a very sophisticated partnership. These guys are already proposing it, quite openly. These are the guys who are populating the China Reform Forum where I spoke last summer. They're associated with two big players, Zhang Bijiang, the guy who came up with theory, peacefully rising China, the head of the China Reform Forum, and Yu Keping, who heads a couple of government reform centers in China. They're trying to build public policy infrastructure. They say it quite openly. They know they got a leadership that has an overhang. This guy lacks imagination, and so does this generation. But you know what? So do all the babysitters with this guy. The biggest problem we got is the Cold War hangover with this crowd. We bought him because he had no experience in foreign policy. But frankly, we're talking about people who were imprinted on China, India, Russia, and these countries years ago. And no matter how much they talk the talk, they simply cannot get over their biases. And that's a problem. Not for long. We have a choice. We can decide China's rising like the United States was at the beginning of the 1900s. Or we can determine it's Kaiser Wilhelm all over again. That's basically your Michael Pillsbury argument. China is the perfect fascist state. It's the perfection of fascism. It's a fantastic argument if you actually travel around China. I mean, a police state is not where a capitalist can come in, level a village, put up a factory, pollute the entire valley, have a peasant uprising, and then the party shows up and says, hey, come on. That is not a police state. It sure as hell isn't fascism. The problem with thinking about China is that it's so spread across time. Okay? Their foreign policy does look an awful lot like our carry a big stick and talk softly. Their space program, I think it's so cute. I raise my glass of Tang. No, really. I thought it was kind of funny. Tang. Their internal investment, it looks like the 1920s America. I mean, the skyscrapers going up in Shanghai. They have 4,000 skyscrapers in Shanghai. They're tearing down old ones they put up 10 years ago to put bigger ones up. Okay? In terms of sports, watch them win the most Olympics in 2008, the medals. My prediction. Social mores, they got a sexual revolution going on. Movie industry, I love it. We haven't seen it since the 1930s. Post-industrial economy, they got that too. Organized labor, they love to crack skulls. Female labor, Rosie the Riveter, coming out, big time. You can locate China across the last 125 years. If you want to catch the best approximation of the rapacious style of capitalism in China right now, I say watch HBO's Deadwood. That is the best approximation. Okay? We have a hard time understanding how big China is. Here's a good way of thinking about it. Take everybody in the Western Hemisphere, 900 million. Then take everybody in Europe, 400 million. Okay? Invite them all to America to live, 1.3 billion. Then ask most of them to live on the coast. That's China. This is a good and apt comparison. China, 3.6 million square miles. The United States, 3.59 million square miles. They got a lot of revolutions going on, all at the same time. What's so funny about the Americans are, they're like, Well, can you become a democracy too? No, really. You're not doing enough. I don't see enough happening. This is the one that's actually going to be the most profound, the demographic revolution. Okay? Ask yourself, which is more likely? China's going to get old. China's going to get rich. Or they're going to get threatening. Which is going to happen first? Which one do you think is inevitable? This one's hard to prevent. It really is. Here's something I don't think most people understand. We're going to hit the Florida mark. China and the United States predicted same year, 2036. Florida mark, 20% of your population over 65. Okay, what's amazing is we will have made the journey from 10% over 65. That will have taken us 64 years. Okay? China's going to do it in 17. They haven't even gotten to that point yet. Okay, we're not sure anybody can do it, except what's the alternative? When we talk about there's going to be 40 million extra Chinese males because they're aborting all those girls and they're giving them away. Bear Branches, that MIT book. They got to put them in the army because they're going to be horny and pissed off. Then they're going to have a war with them. Why? That's how we do it historically. I posed that problem to a lot of people in China when I was there last summer. I mean, everybody from on the street, the senior officials. And what they said, each and every time, is absolutely amazing. They said, let me tell you about the 4-2-1 problem. The Chinese love numerical expressions. 4-2-1. Okay? 4 grandparents, 2 parents, 1 social security system. This guy's not marching off to war easily. And with 100 million Chinese traveling abroad by 2020, we estimate, guess what? This guy can marry abroad. China's balancing acts right now is absolutely phenomenal. They are sucking in foreign direct investment like we've never seen. I mean, the investment they're doing over the next 20, 30 years, nobody's ever done anything like that. It's never been attempted in human history. Okay? They're also one of the most opaque political decision-making systems we've ever seen. This is what keeps Alan Greenspan sweating. Because they said, you know, we'll change the yuan just a little bit. Everybody's like, what? What? Hmm? We're also talking about the global manufacturing superpower. There's Tom Friedman, World is Flat. Who just so happens to be the country most likely to go to great power war with us. Okay? That is an amazing package. I don't think we've ever had one country presenting so much promise or peril at the same time in the system. I mean, it's just stunning. The rest of the second book is basically a description of the journey. Okay? Last point. This is the one that kind of pisses off pretty much everybody in the room. Because I'm going to make an argument that says, in effect, I don't care what you think. I'm really talking to the echo boomers. We're going to be running things economically, which runs everything, frankly, in our system. I know we like to believe inside the Beltway that we actually run things, but frankly, Washington runs almost nothing. The argument I'm going to make here is going to sound a little too weird for most people, but people younger than myself, the generation that comes beyond me, finds this argument compelling, natural, instinctive. Okay? Our assumption coming out of the Cold War, that imprinting we received, and I am talking specifically about a certain age range here. The assumption was, if you're like us politically, you must be our friend. And the converse had to be true. If you're not like us politically, you must be our enemy. Okay? And on that basis, we have neglected a rather different model between us and the Europeans and us and the Japanese on economics, which frankly is pretty profound. Okay? The LDP has given up power once in 50 years. Okay? You can call it a democracy if you want. The echo boomers who come after, okay, they see the world in a different light. They view connectivity differently. This is the assumption, the paradigm we're moving towards. If you're like us economically, you'll be our friend. That will be a huge switch for most people who assume that freedom is defined by politics, not economics. But the best description I got from this was from my friends in China, a reformist who said, before Tiananmen, we said freedom was 90% political, 10% economic. They say, well, that sounds wonderful. Then they say, after Tiananmen, we realized freedom is really 90% economic, 10% political. And my first response was, my God, how sad. And then I examined my own life, and I said to myself, you know what? They're absolutely right. 90% of what I define as freedom is go where I want, buy what I want, do what I want. Nobody tells me. Okay? I vote every once in a while. I yell back at Fox and CNN. So, one view of China by people who can't get off this picture. I've only grown up knowing this guy. Okay? I come of age in 1973. All I knew was crazy old man Mao, Gang of Four, and this guy rescuing the situation. Probably the most influential figure second half of the 20th century, by a ways. So last image. We look ahead. We're going to have more in common with China than we are with Japan. This seems weird to people in politics, but talk to somebody in the IT world. They will tell you, I get China economically. Japan is still a mystery. We're going to have more in common with India than the UK. We're going to have more in common with Russia than with Germany. And eventually, once we co-opt them, we're going to have more in common with Iran, which frankly loves us, than a France. Actually, that's pretty easy to imagine. Okay. Pablo Picasso was asked by Gertrude Stein to do a portrait of her. Famous story. And he showed her the picture after he got done drawing it. And she said, that doesn't look like me. He said, relax. It's gonna. So I say, relax. It's gonna happen. I'll be happy to take questions.